hear me, right, Alan?
Yes.
Okay.
Hello, Alan.
That sounds like
Alan.
Jules.
Yeah, that's me.
Yes.
How you doing?
Good.
Oh, good. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
I'm thrilled that you're able to do this with us. Thank you so much for your time. This is Kate Hampton, by the way.
Oh, good. Good to meet you. Good to meet you finally.
Yes, I've had a grand time with your sister.
Yes, yes, yes.
Well, I think Alan's on the line. It appears everything's working. Are we recording, maybe? We're crossing our fingers that everything's working.
I think we are recording.
Okay.
So I'll just go silent, and Renan will as well, and we'll let you gentlemen carry on.
Okay,
okay,
thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks, Alan. Thanks, Jules.
All right, now.
Oh, today is Monday, June 20th, 2016, and we're starting at 1 p.m. to do an interview with Jules Harrell. And Jules, can you tell us where you're residing right now?
Okay, I live right now in Hyattsville, Maryland. It's a suburb right off of Washington, D.C. here. It's really right close to the University of Maryland, and maybe about a 20-minute drive from the actual center of Washington, D.C.
So today what I'm going to ask you is a series of questions that's part of the African-American Historic Places in Helena, and it's sponsored by the Montana State Historical Preservation Office through a grant from the National Park Service.
Okay, good. Okay.
So the first question I have, and you can take as long as you want to answer any of these questions,
okay.
But when and where were you born?
Okay. As far as I know, I was we were residing at 1076 North Ewing Street when I was born. Now, I have to check that with one remaining aunt, but I don't believe that we were still – I know my older brother, we were living at 1068, my father and mother were living there with their with my father's parents. But by the time I was born, I believe that the 1076 house was either online or came on shortly after that. So we were right in Helena, Montana there, born. I believe I'm St. Peter's Hospital.
And what year were you born?
Okay, that's 1949. November 19th of 1949. And I had an older brother, so I was basically the middle child, and we had another one that came along a little bit later. I had an older brother who was about 2 years older. We're all about three baby boomers, I guess you would say. Myself, Arthur Harrell Jr., that was my older brother, and then Janet is my younger sister, Janet Harrell Campbell, my younger sister. Richard came along in 1960. I don't know if we consider him a baby boomer or not.
What residences did you reside in Helena?
Well, that's interesting. As far as from the time I was born till the time I left out of Helena, we were right there at 1076. That was the home base. That was a house that was really a door down from my grandmother's house, my grandmother and grandfather's house. So my grandfather had actually purchased the lot on 1076, a lot at 1072 North Ewing, and then a lot at 1068 where he lived. And I believe the lot to the left of that house, he owned all four lots. And we lived in the one, my father actually built a house on the one that would be the furthest north of those four.
So can you tell me the names of your father and mother?
Yes, my father was Arthur Samuel Harrell Sr. My mother, Mary Alice Trahan Harrell, and she was actually born in Louisiana, which I'll talk about if you want. And then my father was born in Helena.
And can you tell me how they came to Montana and when?
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, that's one of those kind of. Very, very long stories. We know most, I think, the most detailed information we have is related to my grandmother's side of the family. My grandmother's mother actually came to Helena with her husband. My grandmother's mother was Mamie Bridgewater. Her I guess born name was Mamie Anderson Bridgewater, and she's coming to Helena really with the soldiers who were at Fort Harrison. There was a group of what we, I guess nowadays we call Buffalo soldiers at 24th Infantry at Fort Harrison. And Samuel Bridgewater, her husband, came to Helena from basically out of Fort Huachuca through Salt Lake and then up into Helena to serve at Fort Harrison. Mamie Anderson and we know that she was, in fact, her parents at the time that she was married were living in Oklahoma. They had moved, these migrations are so interesting, they had moved from Tennessee to, Mamie Anderson's parents had moved from Tennessee to Oklahoma, and from a little town in Tennessee that is called Gallatin, I believe, Tennessee, and then, but close by, Samuel Bridgewater lived in Dixon Springs, and I may have those backwards, but Samuel Bridgewater was actually close by, but Mamie moved with her parents to Oklahoma, Meeker, Oklahoma, as far as we can see, and eventually out to Fort Huachuca, Arizona, and then up to Helena, and grandmother used to always sort of pride herself in the fact that she knew she had been born in Fort Huachuca, Arizona. That was her place of birth, and then moved to Helena from there. My grandfather, my grandmother's husband, that would be Charles Henry Harold, that's senior. He was, in fact, a Pullman porter out of Hawkinsville, Georgia, but I believe on the Northern Pacific line, and settled in Montana, and was much older than my grandmother. But settled there and worked around in Helena, catering and doing other kinds of work in Helena. And in fact, that's where he had the three sons, my father and his two brothers.
Are there any other relatives that you'd like to talk about that worked in Helena as you were growing up?
Oh, gosh, there's so many. You know, there's so many relatives around there that, and of the older people, of that older group, I don't have any direct memories of, I have no direct memories of my great grandmother, but, cause she passed in 1950 and I'm born in 1949. Her husband, of course, had died many, many, many years earlier. Her husband came back from the Spanish-American War badly wounded. Now I know some of the documents say he was wounded in the right breast. My grandmother always said in the left breast, but we won't debate that. But he died around 1912 he passed. So those two I don't have direct memory of. Now, I do remember, of course, my Aunt Octavia, who worked in Helena as a nurse and was served in the Army and worked as a nurse in Helena for all of my years that I was there. She was still quite active at St. Peter's Hospital. I had an uncle. My grandmother's brother, Herbert, who worked, I believe it was Elk River Concrete down there. That would be he was the youngest boy, worked there. And so that was my great uncle, my father's uncle, who worked down there. Other individuals, my grandmother, my grandfather was an interesting guy because he, in fact, worked as a custodian at the original Marlowe Theater. And I don't know if the Marlowe, that was a little movie house that we used to go to when I was coming up. He was a custodian there, but he started, was given permission to sell concessions and made a little bit of money on what is now a real enterprise in these movie theaters, that is selling people food as they watched the movies, So he had a fairly bright idea on that. He then opened a catering business, and a lot of the people that, when my mother came to town, she with my father, she was saying he would hire a lot of individuals, a lot of African-American people would be hired with him on these catering jobs, and it was something that it was probably a skill he picked up working for the trains, working on the trains as a cook, how to prepare meals and how to cater these large banquets. So I do have memories of him. I was probably six. I think he passes in 1956, and I have memories of him. It's kind of strange how the mind works. I remember him first with in a wheelchair with one leg, and I was sort of there to kind of see if he needed something. I would go get it. And then toward the very end of his life, they took the second leg. In those days, they called it gangrene. Nowadays, they probably call it type 2 diabetes or something like that. But I do remember, I do have memories of him as a force still around there at that time. Of course, then my father, I have no memories of my father's older brother who dies, and that's Charles Henry Harrell, but the Charles Jr. No actual contact memories with him. He dies in 48 in a plane crash. But he was a force, and my father made sure we had clear memories of who he was, and he planted those memories in us, so it's almost as if we knew him, even though we never saw him. A very talented man, and he wrote a lot of things. So we have a lot of letters and a lot of material that he left us in the written work. He was a biology student at Carroll College, finished biology at Carroll, and quite an interesting kind of Renaissance man, pilot, loved fencing, boxing, all those kinds of things. And then my father's younger brother was Cornelius Harrell, who was a mechanic at Placer Motors, one of the really became the shop foreman there. And he was one of the few people, as I remember, that just enjoyed working on the new, what they call hydromatic or automatic transmissions that were coming out in the 50s. He kind of liked that kind of a challenge to work on those things. So he was another individual I remember working there. And probably a whole host of other individuals that I'm forgetting, but certainly those family members were real, just sort of everyday working kind of people that that certainly had an impact on me.
During the time that your family lived in Helena, were there any incidents or events of local or national violence that affected the African American community in Helena?
That's interesting. Of course, by the time that the civil rights movement, it's really picking up a lot of speed in the late 50s and in the early 60s, right up to the time of toward the middle 60s, you start to see urban unrest in the major urban centers. And then you, of course, see the death of Dr. King in 68. I think what happens is that as the schools are integrated and you see the violent response in the South, there are a number of times there where the National Guard was brought in, and there were actual shootouts between local Southerners resisting any change at all, and certainly resisting the you find this at the University of Alabama, that this occurred, University of Mississippi, it will occur, that there was a lot of turmoil and a lot of people talking in terms of it looked like the federal government was being resisted by a local state authority, And that was, there was tension around that. Now, of course, I think when we were younger, the older people tried to shield us from that, but there were always conversations about and I guess in those days we'd simply call it the race problem. The race problem. How was it? How would it be settled? Is agitation the way? Because there are many schools of thoughts on that. Some people say, well, it would be a gradual change, and others would say, no, you have to push. If you don't push, there would be no change. So, one thing I do remember as a little boy, as a young boy, were the conversations that would be going on around tables and. Around picnic tables or whatever, that people were talking about, well, what's going to happen next? Is there going to be further agitation and further movement in this direction? And of course, there were all different opinions on what way we should go. I think that in that respect, there was always, and this is something that people may deny now, but I know that you can find some record of it. There was always sort of a hidden fear that, oh, what will happen is they will send black people up, you know, into these low populated states and let them live there, and then things will really change there. You know, I remember people talking, or there was sort of like a silent, I mean, among whites and blacks, a statement, well, maybe what they'll do is just sort of resettle people away from, you know, from the South. You know, and I think that caused a certain level of tension and people not knowing what this would mean. Of course, I don't think it was ever a plan, or I've never seen anything formally written on that, but I do remember people talking about that. But certainly you'll find that the way that the, you know, especially the women, the way the women had organized these clubs, in Helena it was called the Pleasant Hour Club, was the club for black women, that, you know, when I was coming along. And they met all, they met constantly, and they did, and they were proactive, not reactive in that sense, Alan. They were doing things all the time. You know, they would have meetings and scholarship funds and those kinds of things. So when there was, you know, problems going on, and when there was agitation or marches and that kind of thing, they would discuss these in their minutes. I've read some of the minutes from these things, and they would send money to support different causes that they sort of agreed were worth supporting, you know. So there was always that feel that there was a connection that they had with the, you know, with the larger outside world outside of Montana. That wasn't something that was simply foreign to them. Kind of an interesting side note on this is I think the idea that as the women would organize into these groups, they would have what they called a state convention. And we have a lot of pictures of the state conventions. I've seen them in certain coffee table books, you know, of the black state, the black women's club, and this would be the Federation of Colored Women's Clubs that would meet in different cities. And it was my understanding from some people that I've met after leaving there that, you know, and oftentimes they would send someone to a national convention. They would try to get a delegate to go to one of the national conventions, and they would sort of report back on what they had heard from national meetings. So there was a connection. There was a strong connection between, you know, that real movement of African Americans in the larger nation and what was going on in Montana. These people were not absolutely isolated from that. You know. We have a very interesting picture of the family of Nathaniel Ford. They lived at 913 Cannon in Helena there. I remember that address because my uncle eventually owned that house for a while. But there's a group of people sitting on you know, in the front, African Americans of different ages. But the woman reading it is reading one of the black, I think it was a Pittsburgh Courier, one of the black newspapers. She's actually reading it as this picture is being taken. So, and this would be a picture from the probably late 20s, early 30s. So people were definitely connected.
Can you tell me some other recollections about the Helena community events that your family took part in as you were growing up?
Yeah, that's really fascinating to me because one of the things I remember, and for so many reasons, is that there was always a picnic in the summer, and it was as I remember, we called it the Pleasant Hour Club picnic, and that would mean we'd probably go. At least my memory is we would go up to a place called Rimini, and there would be a gathering of people not only from Helena but from other, you know, from other clubs in the area, and that would be just sort of a real major event. You know, it was a all day kind of thing. Of course, we would as quickly as we could, we would find our way to the fishing, you know, to the stream to try to fish. Very rarely catching something, you know, but certainly it was just the adventure of it. And so I think those picnics would bring together a large group of people. And my looking at, you know, as I look at old records on this, I see that was something that, of course, predated me, and you know, for quite some time, they just made certain that people would gather in the summer. The other was, of course, that there was an annual Christmas party that we would go to after Christmas, And we would always say, well, you know, it's not over yet. The Christmas season isn't over yet because we still get to go to the Pleasant Hour Club Christmas gathering. And that was, that meant at least one more present, you know, we greedy little children. And we were kind of looking forward to that. But I certainly remember that as an opportunity where the kids would get a chance. If we didn't see each other, you know, that much during the year, we would certainly see each other for that. And that was sort of at a kind of a local community level. I remember those two events. Now, of course, the way it worked in the family is that my Aunt Octavia, who lived at on Piosta Street, 502 Piosta Street, she handled Christmas. And you know, and the overall, you know, the whole family, would that be my father and his brother and my uncles, everyone that was there, they would come over for Christmas dinner at her house. And that was usually a fairly large gathering, you know, but it was a, by today's standards, certainly a very modest house, you know, it wasn't that big. But we would go there and it would always be, you know, just too much to eat. There was just so much food there that she would prepare herself, you know. And the thing I remember most clearly about that is that she would prepare that food. We would sit down and we would eat. And, you know, there'd be a, something, maybe something on television or whatever, people sitting around talking. But she would go and get dressed and go into work. And that was on Christmas Day. She would go into work at St. Peter's after doing all that cooking. And today I think about that and I say, after all that work and all that effort that she made, and, of course, people, some people brought over things, but she did the lion's share of the cooking. She would, you know, she would go into work and work a full shift. My grandmother, and that was at 1068, she would do the, she would do Thanksgiving. And so those were two gatherings that, you know, they sort of put, memory pegs that it'll probably be there forever. I guess, I'll never forget those kinds of things. And it's just so much, it was just such a, it was something that was a constant. Something we could count on, that Christmas would be at Aunt Octavia's, and my grandmother would have the would be Thanksgiving dinner, you know. So those are certainly events that we really look forward to, you know, family events kind of thing.
Can you tell me how your family decorated your properties for some of these special gatherings?
Yeah, no, that was sort of interesting because my father was not the huge celebrationist on that sense. You know, he would say, okay, we had a little tree in the front. He said, if you could, he said, if you want to, you can go out there and throw some on that tree, but that's about it, you know. But the thing I remember about with respect to the Christmas thing is that oftentimes he would say, okay, we're going to get a tree, so we'll go up someplace and get one, you know. And, of course, since I've left Montana, everybody sells these trees, you know, or get some, you know, buy them at Kmart or Target or someplace. But we would actually go up there, and I remember going into the hills with him and finding a tree that would be a good Christmas kind of a tree. I remember that. And then, of course, my Aunt Octavia, she was busy. She would sort of, her thing would be that she would have all the, whatever ornaments her mother had, she would make sure they were out there. And I remember seeing them, you know, those older kind of ornaments that she would have. She was very good at keeping things, you know. And in that sense, it was another constant in life that you would expect to see certain bulbs and certain ornaments that you'd seen the last Christmas that had probably been there for the last 30, 40 years, you know, reaching way back. But we were not – some homes were quite elaborate with the decorations. Ours were a little bit more modest. My mother was quite artistic, so she, of course, would figure out something to do with the Christmas cards. People sent Christmas cards. I guess now they tweet one another or send email. I don't know what they do, but Christmas cards are not as they used to be, but she would make sure she would have a beautiful design of those up in the house. My mother was, in fact, my father and mother met at Xavier University at a historically black college. The only I know of in New Orleans, and she was majoring in home economics there. And when they came to Helena, she brought a lot of skills with her in terms of sewing and you know, just cooking and nutritional sciences. And so she would make certain that there was always a nice, you know, some sort of a beautiful decoration within the house, not outside, but in the house. She would make sure that there'd be with the cars or with other things that she would find to put up. So in that sense, it was I don't know that there's anything that really measures up to Christmas in Montana. You know, it's just a real beautiful, at least it was then before global warming. It was a real beautiful kind of event up there, and they they took full advantage of it. Even with not elaborate decorations, but certainly with that kind of constant thing that they would put up there.
And did they participate in any fraternal or other organizations that were social there in the community that you remember?
The only thing, I remember that formal kinds of things I remember. My father did not. He was he seems to me, and again, I lost him when I was 14. He passed from a heart attack in 1963. So I had just turned 14. And I remember him as being sort of he was not the kind to be all that given to, like large organizations, sort of a family guy, family man. He was there with us. And then working, of course, he would. My mother was a little bit different. My mother was she had some, she was a little bit more on the social side, but she worked a little bit with the, the Pleasant Hour Club and that group, but nothing in terms of, when I was there now, nothing in terms of social organizations outside of those, the Pleasant Hour Club and that kind of thing. I think the other thing
mentioned.
Go ahead. Yeah.
You'd mentioned earlier that there were relatives that served in the armed forces. Are there any other things you'd like to say about that?
Well, of course not. My father and his brother both served in World War II. And I think a lot of my early memories, the picture I'm trying to paint for you is that my grandmother's house was actually one door down from ours, and my grandmother and grandfather's house there. And a lot of what she had in that house really were things that they had sent back from their time in India and their time in Persia and these kinds of, we'd call it Persia in those days, Iran. But they'd send back chairs and prayer rugs and those kinds of things that they picked up there. And, of course, pictures everywhere of their time in the in World War II. So I don't know that I'm reading. I read a lot of material that my uncles wrote, and I think that my father was sort of in the service, and he had had 3 years of college, so he did pretty well in moving up in uncle, his younger brother, was a little bit more military minded and seemed like his future was going to be a little bit brighter in the service if he had decided to stay. Neither of them did, but they certainly served in World War II. It's kind of interesting because for some reason, my father not being he certainly wasn't a military man, but for some reason he re-upped into the reserves, I believe, and got called back immediately after World War II to Korea, and I was born and my older brother, and he was being called into back into another war, and they did some letter writing and things to say, well, he kind of did serve. He served quite a bit over there in World War II. Is there any way he has these two young children? Is there any way that he could be, that he could be absolved of this service? And he was able to get out and come on back without serving a full time in Korea. But he talked about his service days and he seemed to gain a lot from it. He seemed to gain a lot from that. From that period, we know less of. I know less of Samuel Bridgewater, except that it was. He did get involved in in the Spanish-American War, and was involved in a little. He was in the Philippines for a while. I'm reading on that. Very interesting line that I remember reading. Mamie Bridgewater is probably the. I know she's not a soldier, but she was involved with Fort Harrison, and I remember a line that she wrote, and. She talks about, and this is, she's in Salt Lake City, and the soldiers are coming back from the engagement in the Spanish-American War. These black soldiers are coming back in, and she and the other women are waiting to see their husbands come back through. And she has a line in there that says something to the effect that it was the saddest happy day I've ever seen, that something to that effect, because the men came back through, but many of them had been badly wounded, and they came back in there. They came back home. This is at the turn of the century now. Not the same, you know, kind of strapping people had left out, but were in fact were maimed by a, you know, very vicious kind of encounter they had had in the Spanish-American War. So I remember that you know, that there was that pride of service, but they also knew this was a very serious kind of a life that these men had selected. My sense of it is, and again, I say this just to, in that response to the military, you know, what was going on there. My sense of it is that Samuel Bridgewater probably never really recovered from his wounds, and was he was able to work, but he was still suffering off and on from whatever damage was done in that, you know, in that war encounter. And it's fascinating to read Mamie Bridgewater, who again I say was a real force. You know, I don't know, I think that she's one of those quiet movers of history, but she writes about his last week on Earth, you know, and the kind of things that she tried to do to make him more comfortable when he was clearly wasting away from these wounds as a fairly young man.
Can you give me some ideas of the other African American families that you were familiar with in Helena?
And
how did you know them?
Yeah, well, there was a number of people around there. Of course, there was the Leo Calhoun, I'm blanking on his wife's name, lived up on, and this would be on the east side. Leo Calhoun would come over, and a lot of these people were almost bi-weekly visitors. I mean, we'd see them all the time. Some, my mother would cut hair, and she would cut all of our hair, and she would cut a lot of the hair of the, you know, African-American men around there would come in to get a haircut, you know. And Mr. Calhoun would be an individual who would come through, who I believe was also he was rooted from the South and had moved up to Helena. I don't know why, of course, but a very, you know, interesting man, and always good for, you know, there for a good story. The Bankses, my grandmother's very, very dear friend. In fact, we have old pictures of the two of them. They're just very close. Ella Banks, Mrs. Ella Banks, and Ad Banks were very, very close friends and people. We just simply called them aunt and uncle. You know, I didn't know the difference. That's what they were. You know, they're aunt, Ella, uncle, Ad. You know, they were our aunt and uncle, and they had a daughter named Bertrand Banks, who was older than we were, but someplace, you know, a little younger than my mother. But certainly, you know, knew of her. She would be by all the time and come in there. Norman Howard and his wife Maxine at that time were frequent visitors, you know, to the house. Norman Howard, again, being an individual who was always, you know, very, very aware of what was going on in his wife, of what was going on in the world, you know. Their son Ray Howard, who was eventually becomes, I believe, a counseling psychologist. I met him later on when I was at the University of Colorado. He was at one for a period of time at Northern Colorado. But we remember him mainly as an individual who would come by the house, but he was older than we were, and he was a star. He was a star. He was an individual who we knew was a star athlete, but we also knew that he was going places, you know. I remember so clearly and distinctly Mrs. Mattie Williams. And Mattie Williams had three children, Russell Williams, Cordy Hayes, I remember, and Johnny Boy Grady. They were all, Russell was older than we were. Not a lot older, but I'm saying maybe 5 or 6 years older, which I guess is a lifetime in those days. But Russell, my father, really wanted us to sort of emulate that guy. He was an individual who was very serious about his schoolwork, very kind of a controlled individual, and I remember him very clearly. He would come by. Johnny Boy was a boxer around there, a little cat quick guy that moved like lightning, you know. I remember his sister Cordy I just remember she was a very, very pretty sister that we would, we would talk, but we were kind of in awe of her. But Johnny Boy sort of had to, you know, live that kind of hard knock life of, you know, of a guy who had to, you know, had to make it with his fists a lot, you know, around there. But I remember them, you know, that group, you know, very, very clearly. There were others. When my uncle, there was the Oscar Jones and his wife, Mosey Jones. And, of course, the Joneses, they would always be at the Christmas, you know, at the Christmas party. We would see the oldest boy, I believe it was Raymond. And then I remember Charles, and I remember Delmer, and there was a younger brother who came along with my brother Richard. All right, so these, but as I remember, she had five boys, or all boys, and Oscar was a Mr. Oscar Jones was a contractor. He did a lot of cement finishing, a lot of cement contracting, and my uncle, my mother's brother, who had come up from Louisiana, actually worked with him on cement, you know, doing a lot of cement finishing at that time. So these were people who were really, you know, quite, they were there present. Now, it's interesting you would ask the question, though, because there were people who were not there that were present, and they were present by the conversations. You know, in those days, we listened to what old people were saying. I didn't think we had much choice. Sometimes they would talk a lot, and maybe they would repeat themselves, but they would say things. And people like Arthur Ford was an engineer. He came out of Boulder, African-American. And I believe, I would bet that my father was named after him or for him. But he was known as a very real force in the Water Commission in New York City. And so my grandmother spoke of him with great pride. And so even though he would only come through occasionally, and we would see him with Aunt Sadie and some of these other, the Fords in that group, we didn't know him that well, but he would certainly come through, you know. Of course, we knew of Miss Alma Jacobs and what she was doing in library sciences. My own godmother, Miss Marge Duncan from over in Butte, as an educator. These were people that we knew about. Some of them would come by more often than others, but they were very much part of who we, you know, a part of our coming up.
Can you tell me about a time that was one of your most memorable experiences growing up in Helena?
Probably in terms of most memorable, there's so many. There were you have the normal kind of athletic kinds of things that I did. I was involved in the athletics, but some of the memorable experiences, but of course, I think my childhood probably to some extent ended at 14 when my father passed, you know. And I think one of the most memorable things I'll never forget about that was at his funeral. It looked like the cars would never stop, you know, the people, the line going into that, and I believe I might call it wrong, but Resurrection Cemetery, as I remember it. I remember a long line of cars. My younger brother at that time was probably, he may have reached his third birthday, but I doubt it. You know, so he was very small, and it would be my sister. And then my mother, you know, my older brother and younger sister. But I remember the lines and lines of people and the way that the community sort of came around, gathered around, you know, and with an expression of grief like I had never seen before. And I would include in that, you know, shortly before that, we had witnessed the Kennedy procession, you know, the Kennedy funeral. But I remember the way that people just gathered about and came together as one community there. One of the most memorable experiences that that I've ever had. And I think I never can sort of oversimplify, you know, what that experience was like. And of course, shortly after that, you know, I would graduate high school 4 years later and would be gone 2 years after that, you know. But that was certainly very, very memorable kind of an event, probably for all of us, you know, probably for all of us.
And so was gardening done on your family's properties when you grew up?
Yeah, I think, and I look at the pictures, and I can't remember when they didn't garden. I can't remember when they didn't garden. I remember corn on the cob, everything that you could imagine was being grown, my mother just loved that. And I think other people around there did a lot of gardening. So the backyard, a portion of that was always dedicated to gardening. Now, of course, I know that the growing season wasn't extremely long, so they would get in there and get the stuff in. And, there was always, in our place, there was always something called a rhubarb patch. And that was almost, we'd be running, and we'd grab some of that and run off, and that would be like a snack for us, But, yeah, plenty of gardening, and, I think that one thing that I probably can't overestimate, I really want to emphasize this, is that my grandmother, my father's mother, really appreciated the outdoors. And, she and Aunt Ella could tell you more about plants, birds, mountains, just anything you wanted to know. They just really appreciated the outdoor nature of Montana. They just really found that as a renewing for them,
And what was her name?
This is my grandma. This is Mary Emma Harrell. And this was that would be Mamie Anderson Bridgewater. This was her daughter. She would be the oldest daughter.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell me about them?
Well, that's interesting because there's so much there. That's the line we know more. We know that, and we have pictures of, Mamie Anderson Bridgewater's mother and father. And as far as we can see, the birthday for, and this would be Emma Anderson, who my grandmother's named after her, Mamie's mother. The birthday for her is 1840. All right, and she, Mrs. Emma Anderson, she's 1840 and dies in 1911. So, if you the math on that is that she spent her young life and her girlhood and early womanhood during the slavery period. All right. And her husband, there's no real certain date for his, we know he died somewhat after she died, but, it's not really certain, but he's probably around that 1840 period too. But they're the people that moved to Oklahoma and set up a place in Meeker, Oklahoma. And it's from there that people sort of spread out, the Oklahoma territories open up. They have a lot of, we have pictures where they have horses and that kind of thing. There were certainly people who were about, working that land, have some letters where he's actually telling, after Mamie Bridgewater's, I don't believe he wrote these, but on postcards, he's telling his little nephews, and if your mother wants to come back, there's plenty of land here we can work, because they do have the horses and they had the, at that time, the energy to work the land and make something out of it, So this is the parents of Mamie Bridgewater, who in fact, they passed in a place called Meeker, Oklahoma, down there. So that's a line that we're still studying, what their lives were and where people went from that. We can't account for everybody, people sort of move, they're in motion and they sometimes, you can lose track of folks.
So, Jules, can you tell me how you decided to become a professional neuropsychologist?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I kind of had there's something about the behavioral sciences that just sort of fascinated me from the beginning. My father was he actually studied sociology when he was at Xavier. But we talked we talked a lot as, when we were coming through. But I got interested in sort of mental health related issues. I had just sort of an interest in that field. And wound up sort of moving, when I was doing my undergraduate work, sort of moving toward the you know, the study of, okay, what does stress do to the body? How does the body work and those kinds of things? And it was really sort of coming online now that people were starting to understand the connection between mind and body. So by the time I got to graduate school, it was something that we could really get into and study at the University of Illinois in great detail. So I think I was interested in a lot of the diseases that people were suffering and that psychologists were interested in too. For example, people were suffering asthma. My younger sister Janet had asthma, and I said, "Well, I wonder what does stress have to do with that? What does mood have to do with that? How does psychological things operate in that?" And so I actually did my master's thesis on asthma, working with asthma. I moved over to blood pressure after that, studying blood pressure after that. But it was just sort of, very early on, had kind of that interest can we make people better? When people are suffering, can we make them feel better? And I ended up not doing too much clinical work, but that sort of got me, that was enough to shove me in that direction, to push me in that direction.
And can you tell us a little more about how you've helped kind of foster that here in Helena
in the recent couple of years? Well, what happened now in one thing we're trying to do now is, I was always interested in mental health. I remember even as when I was coming out of high school, we would take trips over to Warm Springs and work with people over there, a little bit when I was at Carroll College, and they had individuals there that, we would just go and read with them and talk. And so I was interested then, even at that point. Now, to me, it's fascinating to sort of just, I think that people, the more they know of history, the more that they know of what's going on in the area of neuroscience, it makes them a little bit more hopeful about their own lives, that our own health, our own welfare, we can control these things. We can control how upset we get when someone gets on our nerves, and so I have a nephew in Helena right now, this would be Richard Jr., and he asked me to talk with a class up there, a friend of mine, with my brother-in-law, really, Janet's husband, and we talked with a group of students up there last year about what was going on in the neuroscience and neuropsychology area, So we're always open to, we really try to sort of spread the word on these things, get them, let people become aware that, mental health and well-being, those are things that are sometimes neglected in the grand scheme of things, but they can really have they can make our lives and increase our well-being, make our lives much more meaningful. If we take them seriously, ways of relaxing, ways of sort of renewing our spirit through the arts and those kinds of things. So I'm always pushing that. Every time somebody gives me a soapbox, I climb up on it and tell them about the importance of seeing to their own mental health. I think that's one of the things I really feel strongly about with this project, is that people do have to have a good sense of history. I think the better that they have that, then the more they'll feel connected to a past, a rich past, and they won't feel that they're sort of like mushrooms that just sprouted up one morning. No, you're connected to things.
Well, thank you. Are you sure you don't have anything else you'd like to share?
Well, there's so many things. You know that, Alan, and I wish that there was. I remember Mrs. Smith, I remember that you asked me about memorable kinds of events. And I don't know if I've ever mentioned this before, but we were back on a visit one time. And I remember we went over to see, Miss Jacobs and everybody. My mother took us over there, and Miss Smith was there. And she, I remember her sitting, and we had our oldest daughter with us then. My wife and I, myself, have three children. Our oldest daughter, who's, at that time was probably 5 or 6. And she came in the room, I remember Miss Smith sat up and she said, she greeted everyone. And then she sat there and she told the stories about, Liberia and about travel and all these things and about what was going on there. And I don't think I've ever forgotten that event, man. We talk about that. My daughter this day talks about it. She remembers that. I remember her. I say, yeah, I bet you do, because she came along with my grandmother in that group a little bit before them, So So there's so many other things, so many other stories. You know, I just hope I get the chance to. We're going to make it certain that we get out there and visit, and you know, and exchange even more. You know. But I really appreciate the opportunity just to talk about this stuff.
Well, thank you, Jules. And if you don't have anything else, we'll just conclude for today.
Well, thanks again for just give me a shout whenever you need something.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your time and energy.
No problem. Talk to you later on.
All right. All right. You bet. Bye.
Bye now.